Hello everyone, my name is Lizega Tandwa and welcome to Beyond Politics, a weekly podcast with today's political minds as we journey into their day-to-day lives in and outside of office.
Michael, thank you for joining us. This is something, it's more of my little passion project. So I'm very glad to have you as one of the guests. And I chose you because you're one of the most interesting characters at the Action SA.
Not sure how to read that. Interesting. It's kind of like one of those double-edged compliments, isn't it?
Well, in as much, I mean, you've written a book, but you've written a book about someone else. So we'd like to know more about you. And I think let's start with when Michael was born. You know, you're a Durban boy, born and bred. Just tell us more about where you were born, the influences when you were still in Durban.
Yeah, I call them brews, Durban brews. But yeah, no, I was born in Durban in 1985, so I'm 39 this year. And yeah, born to an incredibly fortunate situation. I think in the South African context, I grew up in probably the most privileged environment you can. My father was a surgeon, my mom was a radiographer. They're still married after many, many years of marriage. And I had the good fortune of attending really good schools. So, you know, I live on the complete other side of the spectrum on privilege. Mm. But I think what's important to me always is to be very mindful of that particular fortunate upbringing that I've had. It's always an interesting thing for me that in Action SA, you know, we have a president who was born to a child-headed household living in a tin shack. And then you have my story, and yet we bring it together in a party that seems to have, to some extent, found expression in both sides of the railway track in terms of its support base. So, yeah, it was a interesting upbringing. It was, I think, a very sheltered upbringing, and certainly took a while for me to develop the level of political consciousness that I think informed a lot of my political choices to follow.
Let's talk about that political consciousness and where exactly is the genesis of it, because you went from Michael House to Rhodes University. Did you find that consciousness at Rhodes University? Is that where the genesis lies?
It actually started in high school. I had a Zulu teacher, Mr. Sandile Kuluse. I still remember his name. And, you know, anyone who's had a really special teacher knows that kind of role a special teacher has in your life. And he was that for me. I suspect in hindsight, he was very IFP by way of his upbringing. And he immediately looked at my argumentative and strongly opinionated nature and said, "You're going to be a politician."
Oh, really?
And I said to him, "No, you're talking nonsense. There's no way. I'd never say that, by the way." I politely said I disagreed or whatever. But he saw that in me from the beginning, and he started to develop a bit of political consciousness with me, which I thought was, you know, quite instructive in those early years. And then certainly when I went to Rhodes, it was a very interesting experience because Rhodes is an institution that's steeped in history when it comes to the struggle against apartheid. We had some very strong lecturers there who certainly awoke a level of consciousness with me. I was actually in the same political class as Mandela Mandela. Mm. So I had those interactions with him and we explored a lot about the ANC at the time. So certainly I think it grew at that point and my love of politics grew. I actually studied politics actually as a random subject, not that I really wanted to pursue a career in politics. But if you have a political bug, which I do, and you get bitten, it's very difficult to let go. And I know that I did some vac work as part of building up a CV with the Democratic Alliance and KZN at the time. And the political bug bit me. I was working with MPs and understanding the work that they were doing and found it hugely interesting. And 3 days after my last exam, I started my first job in politics, which will be 18 years ago next year. So my political career is almost old enough to drink. So I think there's something in that metaphor. And certainly, as I say, the rest will be history.
Now, when you look at, and let's perhaps go back to your Zulu teacher, and when you look at where you come from and juxtapose it with your Zulu teacher who came from the IFP, were you ever, even though it was at the periphery in terms of your upbringing, but were you ever conscious of what was happening in KZN and especially, you know, during the most tumultuous time during the Nelson Mandela years when there was almost a civil war, as one would put it, black on black violence at that time. Were you aware of such things that were happening in your backyard?
To some extent. Mm-hmm. I think my very privileged upbringing certainly kept a lot of that stuff far away from my backyard. So, you know, certainly I think for many people with a similar story to mine, it took a lot longer to realize what was going on. I also think, to be fair, that civil war kind of conflict element began when I was about 5 years old. Mm. So I think my political consciousness was still in nappies at the time. So definitely not something that I was too aware around. But, you know, I do remember a bit later on in life, certainly around the early years of the democracy, you know, various things started happening in schools when the new flag was being introduced and the national anthem and elements associated with the new democracy. There were particular moments where you started to be conscientized, even in a small way, about the changes, and you started asking questions. I think it always took place in an interesting environment, though, because that Durban, English-speaking, so-called liberal kind of environment, you know, often, you know, some folk there have a very subtle forms of racist behavior, condescending and patronizing. And, you know, I think in many ways I was confronted by racism, and I knew at a young age that I hated racism. Mm. It offended me at a young age. I think I always had a very strong sense of justice, and I couldn't understand why that was acceptable. So I think it was more, you know, smaller levels of consciousness that developed over time. And certainly as I sunk my teeth into politics, I have avidly pursued books and stories about this country's history and the leaders who were so important in its development, and looked to consume as much as I could in the absence of those early years, I suppose.
Now you're at Rhodes University. You're obviously taking in all of that history, especially in the Eastern Cape. What then influenced you to go to the DA? Why not the ANC?
Well, actually, I'd always been more aligned to the ANC at the time. And in many ways, I bought into the romance of what the ANC was in terms of the struggle. And its icons and its leaders and what it had brought to the table. But I think by that time, it was starting to emerge that the honeymoon of the ANC was coming to an end, in as much as it was starting to be revealed in fairly kind of technical detail that what the ANC was in liberation wasn't necessarily translated into its governing prowess. I think certainly there were moments associated with the ANC's approach to Zimbabwe and ZANU-PF that I found deeply concerning. And I think it was at that moment that I looked at the DA and thought, you know, this is not a perfect political party by all means, but that there does need to be another strong political party in South Africa, and I could get behind this. Mm. I met some of the people involved in the DA at the time. They were just going through a fairly big set of changes because Helen Zille had just been elected the DA leader back in 2006. And I suppose it was at that time that I believed that this would be the right move to make.
If you can just give us an idea of the conversations that you had in varsity. I mean, I imagine it was a robust debate between different students about where the country was leaning and the vision that you had for the country.
It was. And I think one of the most amazing things about Rhodes University is by the time you get to an honors level, you probably have about 12 students in your class, and you have such a kind of intermittent interactions with your lecturers that quite often you sit at a table at the pub together, or you get hosted for a dinner at their house, and you interact on a very personable level. But it was interesting. As I said, we had some interesting people like Mandela Mandela there, and you know, there were a lot of debates going around, and I think at the time, particularly around the question of the cycles of violence that you spoke about just now in the early 90s, and the kind of elements associated with that, there was a lot about electoral systems and voting behavior, which is something I specialized in, which looked quite largely at the question of whether voting patterns in South Africa were racial and would remain racial. Going forward, I think certainly that was a subject of a great deal of debate. And then particularly around South African political history, it was always a heated discussion because, of course, any discussion with history occasions people to challenge what they're being taught and the points of emphasis. And it was just really interesting to be surrounded by people who were intellectually engaged in the discussion, and people with different perspectives and vastly different to my own. So in many ways, you found yourself learning as much from your fellow students as you did from the lecturers.
Take me through now. You go back to Durban and then you start working for the DA. What exactly was the position you held there, and what were your ambitions in the DA? Did you ever think of entering the politics of the party?
So my first job was called a constituency operations manager. It was for the constituency called North Durban, which, if you know Durban, was everything north of the Mgeni River.
Yes.
So Durban North, Umhlanga, Lelusia in terms of the suburbs, Phoenix, Tongaat, Verulam in terms of those communities, and the whole of KwaMashu. So it was a hugely diverse, hugely challenging view. I knew absolutely nothing. I was wet behind the ears. I was immersed into a world of snakes and sharks. And particularly I found the politics in Phoenix was eye-opening. You know, you had the minority front there, and the National Party still did very well for a long time in those communities. And it was a deep learning experience. I didn't think it was more about ambitions at the time. I think it was just about surviving. But I thrived. I was in a space that I liked. I enjoyed political communication. It was a very junior position. So I literally worked my way up from the very bottom. But soaked up everything I could like a sponge. Which was exactly what I did. And no, to answer the question, I avoided frontline politics for the longest time in my life, right up until the start of Action SA. I've always worked in the background. I've enjoyed the background as a space where you can do a hell of a lot. And you can avoid many of the pitfalls of being in the front line. But in the beginning, it was just about learning as much as I possibly could from as many people as I could.
Now, I imagine you worked with personalities within the DA. You worked with John Steenhuisen, who comes from Durban as well. You worked with Mbali Nduli, who also was a Durbanite or KZN person as well. Tell me about those personalities. How was working with those personalities?
That was interesting. So, I mean, John was actually a member of the constituency, that first constituency as I was a part of. He was a ward councillor in Durban North, and he was the Itakwini caucus leader at the time. So we are going way back in history. But there were lots of interesting characters from around that time. Mbali didn't emerge for a number of years later. It was quite funny. During my term as the provincial director of KZN, I went through a recruitment process where Mbali was recruited. I was very excited with working with her. And it was just hugely entertaining, though, because Mbali is such a character and so magnetic in her nature that it didn't take long before I was making her coffee. And totally, we laugh about it today because she just has one of those personalities that makes you happy to do it. And, you know, obviously her political career just took off in every single way. I think she's probably been one of the greatest losses in South African politics, I would say. But lots of interesting characters for good and bad reasons, I suppose.
When you look at, I mean, the DA during your time kind of ebbed and flowed, and there were different periods where there were significant changes. I would think of, for instance, Mbali leaving, Mosimane Mane leaving, which we'll get to later on, and also Lindiwe leaving. How impactful was Lindiwe's departure from the DA?
Sure, I think it was massive. I think the first thing that I say is that between 2007, when I joined, and right up till Lindiwe's departure, I mean, the party just grew at every single election. Things had always been going very well for the DA at that time. The wind was in its sails. Lindiwe's departure was impactful, but for different reasons. A lot of the people who departed later departed because of kind of change in the organization's direction. I mean, Lindiwe departed because of the manner she was treated by Helen and other people in the party. And I think that was a big eye-opening moment because you had this young, dynamic, charismatic woman who was reshaping the DA in the direction we all wanted because, you know, no one can be blind to the fact that the DA was always an imperfect party. I wasn't, certainly, and I've never believed that parties are perfect. I think they are imperfect and you try and make them better. And here you had Lindiwe, who was moving mountains and really putting the DA in a realm where it's challenging the perception of the DA as a white party, which was always the biggest Achilles heel for the organization. And then when you basically had that blowout and Lindiwe leaving, it was a kind of statement that the DA is going to remain what it always was. And I think that was a major blow to the organization, certainly. And I think years to come, the other departures, you know, took place for different reasons, but you know, they really did take a major dent in the project of diversifying the DA. The DA I grew up in, I'm talking about when I was on the ground daily, you know, I remember that organization, if you were at an event and you didn't have a diverse table of leaders at the top, I mean, you'd be stripped down and whipped because the party was so sensitive about projecting itself in terms of where it was going and having the diversity and being a home for all South Africans. And that's what just makes it so odd to look at the DA now, where it's just done a complete 180 on those values. And it's just odd because the same people who are driving that now were driving the different approach back then.
So in your time, from what I'm gauging is that in your time, you never really noticed, or there wasn't, as you said, it is an imperfect, every organization is imperfect, but there wasn't really a distinction, a massive distinction between black and white during your time. Would you say that?
In terms of
the race relations in the DA.
In the party?
Yes.
Oh, no, there was always a major issue there. Mm. There was always. It was always bubbling under the surface. And, you know, it was always a cause of tension because effectively the project of diversifying the party, you know, which a lot of people bought into, myself included, was hugely important and necessary. I mean, just if you just have an appreciation of maths, you understand if you aim to govern and deliver and change lives, you've got to be in the aspirations of a majority of the country. But to others, it was a threat to their very existence. And I wouldn't be out of line to suggest that a lot of people who, let's just say, would be unemployable outside of politics, underqualified pale males, let's call them, were hugely threatened by that project because they were the ones that stood to lose out. And there was always a tension bubbling under. I think the difference was in those early days in KZN, I was still relatively junior. So I experienced at a very different level. I wasn't part of the national decision-making structures of the party at that point. But certainly you'd watched how it played out and you observed it carefully in the political leaders around you from KZN engaging around what was going in those national meetings. And certainly that was eye-opening.
I want to now get to the late and former Federal Council Chair, James Salf, and perhaps if you could share his influence on your life and professionally. How was that relationship?
It was a very important one to me. It only started, though, when Herman Mashaba became the mayor of Joburg and I became Herman's chief of staff, because ultimately there had to be interactions between the mayor and the party in terms of the government. And I think everyone, Herman included, kind of said, look, Herman's not a party guy. Don't kind of bog me down with this kind of stuff. I just want to go and be the mayor. So a lot of that was for me to be the interface between our government and the party and providing the relative assurances about what was being done and the management of crises. And that had me interacting a lot with James on a daily basis. And it was just a huge, huge persona. Probably one of the most undervalued people in South African politics. And he just, he rubbed off on me in a big way. He's got a wonderful way of dealing with stress with humor. And yet there must have been so much stress in his life. He always operated with a high degree of precision and excellence in what he did. I used to love his command of the English language. I find language to be one of the most powerful things when language is weaponized in the political cause. And I definitely learned a lot from him in that regard. And certainly I know now in the work that I do as the national chairman of Action SA, even though comparatively the organizations are of different sizes, you know, I still draw a lot on the things that I learned from James in those early years.
Now, I want to talk about you moving from Durban to Johannesburg. And maybe this might be very uncomfortable and an uncomfortable question, because there was a lot of talk about why you had to move from Durban to Johannesburg. And maybe you could just clear up the rumors that still exist around that. And without delving too much into your personal life, but if you could just share what was the reason for the transition, and if it had anything to do with the current leader of the DA.
Okay. No, look, I mean, for what it's worth, there's no problem. I'm open book in these regards, but they were largely two separate events. There was some degree of relation. But, you know, effectively, and I think it's commonly known that I was married in 2010 to someone I worked with in KZN. And about 3 months into our marriage, she began an affair with John Steenhuisen, who was the DA provincial leader at the time. And obviously I was the provincial director. He was the leader. And that's kind of like the SG and president of another party. So you're working together daily. We were very close and interacting very closely, which made things terribly difficult. It was a difficult time, and it was a terrible thing to go through. Because it was a hugely public matter. I know it had a terrible impact on my family, or really private people. You know, they're not like me. They're not open to having their names splashed around like that. And it was a difficult thing to go through. But we went through it anyway. And, you know, a lot of people try to make the story about who I am politically now in 2024. And I think they do so fairly maliciously, because we're talking back 2010. I mean, we're talking ancient history now. And to give you the idea, I mean, I remained in the DA for 9 years after that incident. So, I mean, there's certainly nothing about my political choices today that have anything to do with those events. Those events are ancient history. I mean, John is happily married. I'm happily married. I've been married for 7 years. In many ways, I think it was a blessing in my life. So, you know, it was a difficult thing to go through, but, you know, certainly not something that framed my politics or framed who I am in any way. But, you know, my reason for leaving was, I suppose, partly informed by that. He had stepped down as the DA leader at KZN at the time, and I was working with Sizwe Mthunu at the time. But I think the decision to go to Gauteng was also largely driven by the opportunity there was in Gauteng. And KZN, you're an opposition party for in perpetuity. I mean, the DA is not going to govern KZN outright at the time until Jesus comes. It was fairly clear.
And doesn't look like it ever will. In
fact. Well, yeah, I think it's fairly safe now. But, you know, the point is, Gauteng was an interesting place because you had a lot more voters who were mobile in their political choices. You had a fascinating dynamic that the 2014 election was shaping up in such a way where it was going to be a dead shootout between the ANC and the DA. Both were tracking in the 40s, and you could have very easily had a government there. The EFF obviously really threw a kind of hand grenade into that, a whole other story. But I think the opportunity to go to Gauteng was exciting for me. And I must tell you, looking back, I've absolutely loved it, because I think this is a province that operates at my pace. I like the pace of life. I love the vibrancy of Gauteng. Even when I go to places like Cape Town, no matter how beautiful it is, I love Joburg. And I don't think I'm always going to be a Joburg person.
Now you get here and you become Hemant Mashaba's chief of staff, and you're talking about how Hemant wasn't really a party man. He was all about, I just want to do the job. And we had the same inclination when we were looking at Hemant as well. Our opinion was that he was not really a party man, which he hasn't been shy to say so himself. But how difficult was it to manage a Hemant Mashaba?
Let me just be clear, you don't manage Hemant Mashaba. Hemant is his own person. And I say that proudly, and often because people try to be malicious about this story. I mean, Hemant is a 64-year-old man. He's achieved major things in life. You know, he certainly doesn't need someone in his 30s managing him. If anything, I think what there was an appreciation that there was a kind of balancing of one another, which worked quite well, in that I'd been in the party, I'd been in party politics, and, you know, we could certainly complement one another's blind spots a little bit. And to answer your question, it was hugely challenging and entertaining and thrilling and exciting all at the same time. But, you know, you could look back now and laugh at it, but I suppose at the time you really did want to tear your hair out because the DA was going through a phase where it had just now entered all these metros. And I mean, anyone will tell you that DA's nature in those situations is to become micromanaging. Mm. They want to know where the paper clips are and, you know, that level of detail. And Herman's a big picture guy. Don't bog him down to the paper clips. It's not his thing. So when we had those interactions, it was often about managing those interactions where quite often, you know, Herman would turn around and say, listen, if you don't trust me to do this job, you can bring someone else in. I didn't ask for this job. You asked me to do it. And I suppose what just emerged that was so interesting there is that every other political leader I'd worked with, they owed their position and any future position to how the leadership loved them or how they served the leadership. Mm. Whereas Herman's like, guys, I didn't apply for this job. You asked me to stand for it. I've got other things to do in my life. This is a terrible job, but I'm doing it because I love my country. And what it created was a dynamic where the party leadership became terrified of him because he was this uncontrollable guy. And I mean uncontrollable in a bad way. I mean uncontrollable in the sense that he couldn't be controlled.
He was independent.
By his future ambitions. Yeah. He wasn't trying to be the premier candidate and you know, endearing himself to party leadership. He just wanted to govern Joburg well. And that was terrifying to a lot of people. And that's why I think for that transition the DA went through and that kind of hostile takeover that took place in the DA between 2016 and 2019, Herman was the lightning rod for a lot of that, which is interesting because on one hand, he wasn't a party guy. So he was never going to be challenging anyone for leadership or anything of that nature. But the fact that he wasn't going to be controlled, the fact that he wasn't, someone who could be put under a thumb, made him a massive threat to some people. And I suppose the fact that he started to make some achievements in a place like Joburg, breaking the narrative about things, also made him a massive threat to some of those people as well.
Do you think that you were...
Before you go, I have to share. There's some funny stories, though, because this brings in James Self, which is where it gets funny. So Herman holds the record for firing the most MMCs of any mayor. And I often had to be the one who would take Herman's request to the party and facilitate, because to fire an MMC in a political party requires a political process in the background. And it was with great humor. The first time I phoned James, he's like, okay, fine, you know, let's do this, we'll do that, we'll get it done. The second time he's umming and ahhing. The third time, James answered the phone with an expletive, I won't repeat, saying, who's he firing now? So it became a source like that, but it was interesting operating with someone who was entirely not political in their makeup and the way they operated.
I perhaps now will ask you if do you think that you were the casualty in, in the him and Mashaba versus the party fight or battle?
There's no question. At the time, you know, I was picking sides. Mm. You can't be in that position and serve two masters. And what was just interesting at the time, though, is that the people in charge of the DA at the time were the people that were aligned to Herman. Mm. It was the people who were taking over the DA at the time who were not. So it wasn't so much that I was interfacing with those people, but certainly, you know, it was a strange situation where a lot of those people would see me as a threat, imagining somehow the role I was playing. When I remember to this day that when Herman made that speech resigning, and he obviously, as Herman tends to, kind of speaks.
Who wrote that speech, by the way? Was it you? There's been talks that it was you who wrote that speech.
I don't remember. I mean, look, there's always people who contribute to a speech. The one thing I can tell you, though, is that Herman has the final say on what he says and the way in which he says it. So certainly I could tell you that would have definitely been the case. But I remember I went home that evening. I was very deflated. I was dealing with a team of staff members who were now basically unemployed, to whom, you know, I was responsible for looking after them. So it wasn't my happiest moment in politics. And I got a WhatsApp from Helen Ziller saying, like, did you write that speech in the traditional Helen Ziller way? Like, no, congratulations on all that you've achieved, and I hope you guys are all right, or any of those kind of things. And I remember just being insanely irritated at the time. And I just said, as someone who served as a political principal, I'm sure you'll imagine that whoever writes a speech is secondary to whoever delivers it. Mm. And if you have issues with what's in the speech, you should take it up with that person. So it was very clear that the target was on my back at that time. But I didn't leave because there was a target on my back. I left because the organization in 2019 was unrecognizable to the one that I joined in 2007. And for that reason, I took the decision to say that I can't be here. And I took that decision because I didn't get into politics to serve a political party. Mm. I got into politics to serve a political ideal. And political parties come and go. They are vehicles. And I'm certainly not someone who will hop from one party to another in the fashion of a Jimmy Money or an Abel Tao or any of these characters. But if the party that I'm in is not serving its intended purpose and the reason why I've got there, I cannot be a rent seeker and just stick around because they pay my bills. I have to move on and I have to create something that's going to serve my agenda.
So when you wrote that letter, you know, terminating your membership, who did you refer it to? And what was the reaction of the political leadership at that time?
Well, I actually sent it to John Moody, mm-hmm. who was at the time the DA provincial leader, and Mike Moriarty, who was at the time the DA provincial chairperson, both of whom had been kind of mentors in my life. When I came to Gauteng, we'd worked together very closely from day one. But I don't think any of them were surprised. I think they knew. I think, firstly, they knew about the way in which we had become a lightning rod to those people who were taking over the DA. I think they were sympathetic to what we had gone through. And I think at the same time, there was a difference. I think they agreed with every issue I had with the DA. It was their issues too, if I read between the lines right. I mean, John obviously left and joined Action SA, so very clearly so. But I don't think my resignation came as a surprise to either of them. But it was a very low-key event. I didn't publicly resign. It wasn't a press conference. I don't think anyone would have known who I was, quite frankly, at the time. I was completely in the back office. But it was nonetheless a very strange and quiet moment. And I guess what was just so strange about it is I'd served the DA for 11 years at the time, which is no joke. And it was probably one of the quietest departures anyone would ever not have noticed.
Were you disappointed by the non-reaction from the leadership, given how much you had contributed to the party, both here and nationally as well?
No, I don't think so. Look, nationally, I wasn't surprised at that time. I think Helen had been elected. Musi had resigned. John was the acting leader, and I certainly wasn't anticipating any tears to be rolling down their collective cheeks. But, you know, in terms of the provincial leadership here, not really. I think in many ways they identified with a lot of the issues I took with the party. And they had been part of that journey in the city of Joburg, which had soured with the party. They had worked very hard, by the way, to save that relationship. They saw the value of what was going on there. And I think they were as frustrated as I was, because here you have people who had given so much of their lives, John and Mike, so much more than I have, to making the DA a vehicle that's more appealing to more people. They understood that. And here you have the DA now running Johannesburg, which is, you know, the biggest opportunity you can ever imagine. And we found ourselves doing things that were, you can't do in opposition. In opposition, all you can do is bang the table and send out statements and produce hot air. But here we were in government electrifying Kliptown, the home of the Freedom Charter, 16 years into our democracy. I mean, that's a massive, massive moment. And when you walk away from that, you walk away from the opportunity to deliver trust, because you can't speak trust away. If the majority of the country doesn't trust your organization, the only way you're going to change that is if you go and deliver real services to them in such a way that you show people you care. And I think walking away from that opportunity and the party collapsing that opportunity was, you know, something that probably stuck in the throats of all three of us at the time.
Now, I want to get into what you're saying before I get into the book, The Accidental Mayor, which I think a lot of people who are, more especially people who live in Gauteng, need to really read. But I want to talk about the missed opportunity of the DA, because that was him and Mashaba at that point was at his most popular in terms of the communities of Johannesburg, and what people, the reception he was getting was that he was doing a good job, and the reaction was that he was doing a stellar job, not only from communities, but from political parties, both in the coalition and otherwise. Do you think that the DA was primarily focused on its own interests, personal interests, or do you think that the relationship between the him and Mashaba and the DA was so irreparable that nothing could, and so damaged that nothing could do to kind of repair any of the issues that both party and the man had?
So it's hard to say, because at the time the DA was a schizophrenic organization. There were two DAs. The DA with which we identified had just lost the battle for the heart of the DA. With the election of Helen Ziller, et cetera, and the resignation of Musi, that part of the DA had lost. So there was massive resonance with that part of the DA and Herman. In fact, that part of the DA was trying to convince Herman to challenge for leadership of the party in that particular moment. But it was the other side of the DA that had taken over that was massively opposed to everything Herman stood for and who he was and what he was doing. And the problem was those are the people who had the levers of power. And if you have an understanding of how the internal party machinery works, incumbency is a massive advantage in dealing with these situations. And what we just dealt with on a daily level was just so irretrievable in terms of the breakdown, because basically they would weaponize the relationship with the party and our government to the point where, you know, someone would write up a negative story about our government, which, you know, in politics it happens every day. In other words, you can't live and die on whether there's a negative view. But they would snowball that into a proverbial mountain, and suddenly there would be investigations and whatnot over absolutely nothing. And it was fine. You'd go through weeks and months of dealing with them and showing them that this is nonsense, this is what's being done, and this is why it's all right, etc. And then they would move on from that one to the next thing. And eventually it was just becoming so all-consuming for our time when we were trying to govern and trying to focus on what was going on that it became quite difficult to really manage things in that kind of way. So I think it was irretrievable in terms of those who were in power and the direction the DA was moving. And I think for what it's worth, if you look at the DA then and the DA now, I mean, that concern's been vindicated, because if anything, they kept going in that direction. They didn't kind of self-correct and land up somewhere more in the middle. So definitely, you know, irretrievable, I would say.
What was your relationship with Musi Maimane at that time? And what was your reaction and opinion about Musi Maimane, both his resignation as well as how he was conducting himself within the party? Because there were a lot of people, especially the black leaders, who felt that Musi Maimane was not really in union with them. Musi Maimane was the man, the party man, and someone who was leaning more on the white leadership of the DA, and that they didn't have him as an anchor for the black caucus. I think they were called the black caucus at that time, if I remember the terminology. But what was your own opinion about Musi and how he conducted himself as a leader?
It's challenging to say. I've never been particularly close with Musi. We had a strained relationship for different reasons. But when he was the premier candidate for the province in 2014, there were a lot of people who, you know, felt, you know, sentiments against him because he just come in and got all these opportunities and just risen straight to the top, etc. And I think in many ways that caused distrust between him and I, even though we never actually had a problem between the two of us. He just kind of rolled in different circles, and for that reason we didn't really have a close relationship. But you know, his tenure as a leader was an interesting one, because in 2016, under his leadership, the party reached the height of 24%. I mean, 1 in 4 South Africans were DA voter back then. You know, so definitely his election had a massive effect. But I think sometimes it was, you know, an extent to which he became beholden to certain people who he deemed had helped him get to where he was. And it was unfortunate because I think he underestimated his own agency. And I think part of the reason why Herman felt he had to leave was because, you know, when Musi needed to stand up and be the leader, he didn't. At that time when the review report came out, it was the most strangest thing. I mean, Musi signed off on this review committee of the former leader, a former CEO, and an influential DA donor. I mean, everyone around him was saying, don't do it. It's a setup. I mean, obviously, you know, it's like Back to the Future, you know, like what's going on here? And yet he did. And then when the report came out, which, you know, obviously, you know, just went off to him almost entirely, he had every right to turn around then and say, well, you know what, let's call a conference and let's ask the structures of the DA who should lead. And, you know, Musi was elected with a 95% kind of mandate in 2015. He would have walked an elective conference back then had he done so. And I do remember at the time, Herman and other leaders of the party were saying, lead, we'll follow you. We're behind you, but you must lead. You have to take that first step. And I don't know why, but it never happened. And I think that's why when there was this transition towards the DA as it is now, it's where there was no hope for people like Herman and I.
I want to ask about the accidental mayor. When did you start drafting that book? because you know, it was eye-opening in terms of what, when you came into government, what you saw, the rot in Johannesburg, but also eye-opening in terms of him and his position in the party as well. So it would be interesting to hear when you started crafting that book.
It's the strangest thing. I mean, because it was never intentioned to be a book. I actually had the habit late in the evening when I couldn't sleep, I'd start writing the things that were going on. And I almost did it as part of like a therapy exercise, because when you go into the city, you're just so shell-shocked by what you're experiencing and the sheer kind of like, you know, traumatic disorder that you kind of get confronted by. That I started writing this stuff down, and before long started taking shape. And I remember in our final months in office, you know, I finally said to Herman, you must have a look at this. I've done this. I don't quite know why I've done this, but I think there's a story that should be told here. Just because, you know, the sheer novelty of an outsider coming into politics at the time in which its party was going through this internal kind of coup while governing a city successfully, but in a madly chaotic environment. I mean, it just came together like a political horror. And yet there was so much in it. So eventually it became the book. We published it. Literally it was supposed to be on the shelves, I think, 2 weeks after the COVID lockdowns began. So it was one of those things where eventually 3 months into this lockdown, the publishers, Penguin and I, are like, well, we're going to have to make it available somehow. Otherwise, this thing's going to get old. So it was made available, but obviously greatly impacted by the time, like so many other things were in COVID lockdowns. I think it came with 4 lawsuits at one time, which, interestingly enough, all went nowhere. And I'm so happy we've gone past that prescription period now where they can't, because it's a terrible thing when you start getting legal letters, et cetera. But a massively eye-opening experience. And it was interesting to share because at that time, I'd always been in the background in politics, and here I was very publicly telling a story. So it was deeply uncomfortable, and yet kind of got the sense it was a story that needed to be told.
Cathartic, as it were.
Yeah, I think it was. It was definitely some therapy in there somewhere.
I then want to find from you, I mean, him and starting this political party, was this something that you set? And I hear that Herman loves his wine. Set and had a glass of wine, and then you decided to form a political party. What was the conversations that were led up to Action SA taking shape?
So it was actually a couple of months before Herman left. I mean, I think Herman saw the writing on the wall when it came to the direction the DA was going in. And we were in a flight somewhere on the way back from somewhere, 40,000 feet in the air, when he dropped this bomb on me. So we should start our own party. And I said, no, Herman, I don't think we should. Because obviously I have a much more keen understanding of what's creating, not creating, none of us knew that, but what running a political party meant and kind of political entrepreneurship is definitely not for the faint-hearted. I knew that at the time, and I know it a whole lot more right now. But I kind of said, no, Herman, we can't do this. And he was bullish because, you know, Herman, as he tends to be, he says, Michael, we can go into business, but for what? If our country is going to continue in this direction, I mean, what are we going to do in business and for how long? So I kind of reluctantly agreed and we started exploring it. And Andre Kutsia, the other co-founder of the party, bought into it, which was hugely important because he's the silent partner that very few people talk about, but he's in many ways been the brain of the operation. And yeah, we made the decision to begin the People's Dialogue in December 2019. And shortly after that, launched the party, which in many ways was so much easier to perceive of when there was just three of us because it was just a simpler time. At the time, our meetings were just on Herman's balcony and we'd sit there and we'd talk nonsense and whatnot. And obviously, it's now developed into something that's a whole lot bigger, a whole lot more complex, gives a whole lot more headaches, but I suppose is available to a whole lot more people at the same time.
And I mean, in terms of when you were engaging people during this dialogue, a lot of us thought that you would rope in Musi Maimane as well, and it would be a collaboration between these two powerful DA leaders, as they both held agency at that point. And I think Musi's popularity, it was starting to dwindle when Action SA was forming and he was still doing his own thing. Were the discussions with Musi Maimane around him coming in and why didn't he come in?
There were, and they were dangerously close to happening. But ultimately, you know, there was always this challenge that I think Musi had to imagine himself as the leader of the party. And I mean, I sort of get that because, you know, he'd be the leader of the official opposition and be the leader of the opposition parliament, etc. And, you know, Herman was like, of the mind, was saying, look, it's not that I have to be the leader, but we left the DA because you didn't provide the leadership we needed at the time. And we need an organization that's strong and is going to be decisive. I mean, the work of starting a new political party is hugely challenging. There's lots of people who are infiltrating and trying to undermine and take the organization in different directions. And you've got to have people who are, you know, decisive and foresee these things and act definitively to address them. And I think ultimately it didn't happen for that reason. But, you know, there's always been ongoing discussions between the two parties because it was always going to make a good fit. And I'll say this because, I mean, I don't want to be unfair to Musi in the remarks that I make, is that he's a hugely charismatic, strong individual. You know, when he speaks, he's captivating. And I think it would have made an excellent team and still may one day because both of these parties find themselves in a position where their market share is challenging. The center of South African politics got squeezed hard in this last election where the peripheries are where the growth lay. And ultimately, both of our parties and others are going to have to reimagine our place in the political marketplace if we're going to move beyond where we are into greater positions.
If I'm going to, I want to go to the multi-party charter, but I want to ask you about why you accepted the position of national chair. You are someone who has always been on the background, not really had any ambitions to be in the front of politics. What made you decide I can be the national chair? And essentially, you are the SG of or the Secretary General, the CEO of the party.
Yeah, it was strange. I mean, a lot of things, these roles developed with the party more than anything else, but you know, my experience in the DA was that there was a classification of politicians and staff in two different ways, which became very negative in the DA because, you know, the latter became kind of second-rate citizens who didn't have a political voice. Whereas, you know, when we set up Action SA, we said your voice has got to be directly proportional to your contribution. Whether you're defined as a staff member or politician is secondary to the question of what value you bring to the organization. Some staff members bring more value than scores of politicians and vice versa. So we try to break down, tear down that divide to say that everyone's a politician in a political party, whether you work in the background or the foreground. And ultimately, I guess, it was just the nature of not having enough people in the organization where you couldn't sit in the background. We didn't have that luxury. I mean, in the beginning, there was literally five or six people, and media queries would arise. I mean, in the early days, I was the media officer as well. We all had like five or six different jobs. I mean, Herman was his own secretary. We all had multiple jobs. We all did our own work. And I mean, before long, I suppose you just got thrust into the public space more than there being a conscious decision. But, you know, I knew I could do the work. It wasn't that I'd looked at the work and it terrified me, or that others in those roles are so daunting that I couldn't possibly imagine that I could do it. It was having to move out of a comfort space and into something that was going to be uncomfortable for me.
And then you started attracting a lot of personalities, a lot of DA personalities, and I imagine that put you in, you know, in as a target for Helen Zille as well. I mean, a lot of DA leaders, John Moody, Bongani Baloyi, left the DA and came to Action SA. Was that reassuring to you in the path that you were taking?
It was and it wasn't. So it was good to bring some of those people on board because we were desperately short of experience. And you need political experience in the complex decision-making of a new political party. But at the same time, we had to be very careful not to end up in a direction where the parties just seem to be a kind of, you know, offshoot of the DA, which I suppose has been the challenge for us all along, because it's very easily to be seen as DA light and be branded that way and to have all the same toxicity issues of being, you know, the offspring of the DA, which, you know, we wanted to avoid. So, you know, at the same time, we were very mindful that we were setting up something. I said we were going to be different. And yet you had a lot of people coming from the organization we wanted to be different from. So it was a bit of a double-edged sword for us in that way, I suppose.
I can't imagine how difficult it was for your wife. At that time, because most of your time, I would imagine, I mean, you're starting a new political party, it can't be easy. It's the hours that you have to put in, time that you have to put in into that. How strenuous is that in terms of your personal life as well? You know, your relationship with your wife, your family, your mom, your dad, your siblings, your friends.
Yeah, very strenuous. I think that strain started from before when I went to work in the city of Joburg. And I think up until then, we weren't yet married at the time, but my now wife was, you know, we could still...
We were still courting her.
Yeah, exactly. So I was showing her the sunny side of life, you know. But no, I mean, I think we had much more time together and much less pressurized environment. She was a political person as well. I met her in politics. She was a councillor in Johannesburg. She resigned when Herman and I went into the city because she just said she kept rocking up at these circles of people who were talking about us. Said, wow. I'm not going to be that person. But she's talented and smart enough that she's moved into the private sector and she's doing great work and enjoying herself. But certainly, I mean, it's had a major toll on everything. And I think politicians are often very selfish in that kind of way because we run around doing what we believe in. It's very taxing on us as individuals, but there's always an underappreciation of how taxing it is on everyone else around us. Particularly, I mean, you can imagine the launch of Action SA took place in a hard COVID-19 lockdown. She was sitting a few meters away from me throughout that entire period of time and tearing her hair out in terms of having to listen to all this stuff and deal with all this stuff. But I think the fact that she came from a political background and she's understood what it means to work for something you believe in really does matter. And she's always been an absolute soldier for me that way. She volunteers at our voting station that does the count until 4 o'clock in the morning. And she's been hugely supportive despite all the strain that I think has taken out on both of us.
Did your mom and dad, you've spoken about your mom and dad being academics in the medical field, your father, did they have an affiliation in terms of political parties? And when you told them that you were going to embark on this new project, what was their reaction?
I think they were terrified. I don't think they were ever very excited about me going into politics. I think they saw that it was a good fit for me as a person. But I think they always thought it was going to be a very challenging environment. I think they were very nervous about the change that had been making because, you know, they come from a neighborhood that's been DA for so long that, quite frankly, that community is there in Durban will continue being DA forever and a day. It's just the nature of those places. So all of their friends and all of their colleagues and all of their circles would have been strongly opposed to the move that I was making. But, you know, I was very proud of them because, you know, I think they were proud of me. They stuck with me. They didn't always understand it, and it definitely took a lot of conversations. But they were always with me, and I've watched them develop their own political consciousness with me as I've gone along this journey, which has been fascinating to observe in them. To the point where, you know, they can sit in front of you now and tell you about these things. And, you know, they have their own strong views in these matters and, you know, canvas in their own circles. So it's been an interesting development watching people who are obviously far advanced in their lives and their experiences, and yet they're undergoing a bit of a journey at this time. So I think I've probably put them through a lot as well. And if they're listening to this, I apologize to them too.
Now, let's get to the multi-party charter. I mean, we've had conversations about the MPC, and I think you know my views on the MPC. I always questioned why Action SA would get into this kind of arrangement with the DA, and I always felt that, you know, it was going to be advantageous for the DA and put you at a great disadvantage, considering that there is that constituency that you were trying to attract, which is part of a DA constituency, and the DA, knowing how it had worked in previous coalitions and campaigns, it had always kind of overshadowed its political partners. And why on earth would you go into this? And I think I've asked you this question quite a number of times. And when you look at it in hindsight, do you still think that was a good decision on your end?
It's a challenging question, and it's a question that constantly gets raised in Action SA because, you know, we actually went through a process as a party where 92% of our people said do it. And it was based on what we knew at the time. And obviously at the time, you can only make decisions based on what you know. And what we knew at the time was there's a credible chance of removing the ANC from power. And there's a group of parties that are willing to break new ground and do something that's never been done before. And that this concept could be so revolutionary, so such a novelty, that you really could activate markets of South Africans who have just checked out of the political system. We all know those are the biggest markets that remain completely disengaged from voting. Yeah. And if you could really get in there and do that, you could change everything. And we believed, I think rightly so at the time, that a rising tide would indeed lift all boats, and that perhaps an election where these political parties weren't at each other's throats and actually were co-presenting ideas could, you know, galvanize enough people to make a major difference. It was made on the basis of what we believe was right for the country. We were always aware of the risks. We weren't naive about the nature of the DA and who they are. But they themselves put on a fairly credible showing. I mean, you were there. I mean, they presented a commitment to the South African people that they would not go into coalition with the ANC shortly after the elections. And boom, look around. Because, you know, very clearly they saw this as a opportunity to neuter their political opponents with kindness. And what they did is they used the MPC to basically go to their kind of traditional supporters who had now started breaking away to parties like us and the Freedom Front and the ACDP and others and say, well, why buy retail when you can just buy wholesale, which is exactly what they did. And as you say, the toxicity of their brand to a lot of the people who we would have resonance with in townships kind of say, well, I can't handle my vote being given to the DA, you know. So, you know, definitely not. And they found other political homes. You know, the extent to which you can measure these things is hard because, you know, take a look at Raz, Mzansi and Bosa, two political parties that didn't join the MPC, and you can hardly say that those were thrilling successes. But, you know, in hindsight, it was a problem, and particularly because, You know, the DA just saw this as a stalking horse. They could have their cake and eat it too. What they could do is they could go and campaign for change, acting like the mature big brother who was bringing everyone to the table. Meanwhile, it's been revealed that they've been in talks with the ANC the entire time. And I think that was always the plan, to campaign for change and use it as a stalking horse to negotiate a collective bargaining agreement with the ANC.
You suspected that. I know during our talks there was a level of apprehension, and there was a suspicion around whether the DA was talking to the ANC in those closed meetings with the DA. Particularly, I will refer to John Steenhuisen, who was one of the people who you were negotiating with, and Helen Ziller to a certain extent. Was there reassurance that there weren't any discussions with the DA?
So firstly, Helen Ziller was never in those talks, which I think is interesting, because typically anything without Helen, you're not sure how much gravity it has in the DA. But what was interesting is that she was never at the table.
Did you question that?
Internally. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't think we have the arrogance to think we should tell a political party who they should be sending. In fact, one of the debates at the time was the DA said they only want the leaders of the parties. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we in the Freedom Front and other people turn around and say, sorry, Chief, you can decide who represents you. We'll decide who represents us. And the thing as serious as this is like a 2 or 3 man team. Mm-hmm. It's a team negotiating this, kind of individuals in a serious discussion. I mean, CODESA wasn't individuals. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a team of people. And we didn't presume to tell the DA who their team should be, but you know, the absence was definitely noticed, and interpreting it was, you know, something that we were all trying to understand. But the reason why we ultimately believed what was going on is that the whole time, the sticking point in the MPC was the issue of the intentions towards the ANC. We had a very strong view that nationally, the situation in South Africa is entirely a product of ANC governance. And therefore, we should be very clear that we're not going to go into coalition with the ANC after a national election, because that's the alternative we're trying to create here. And it became a very difficult debate, because we wanted to see other political parties at the table, all of them. Quite frankly, it should have been everyone outside of the ANC, which if you look at the numbers today, that would have been a government. And it doesn't matter that you find things abhorrent about some of these parties, and it doesn't matter that you're disagreeing
with some of the things that they say. Which they are now in the GNU with, by the way.
Yeah. And I mean, it doesn't matter that, you know, these things are a problem. You must work together with everyone to change the direction of this country. Ironically, Gayton McKenzie wasn't given access, but, you know, now it's co-governance together. So that's an interesting story. But at the end of the day, you know, we felt it should have been an open invitation and really, you know, everyone invited. What was also important is it should have been a collective invitation. But the problem for a lot of parties is how it was initiated. So there were discussions between a bunch of parties at the time to initiate this thing. And then what the DA did was seek to misappropriate it by announcing it at their elective conference. And in doing so, they made it a DA thing, the Moonshot Pact, they called it, which just automatically drove a whole bunch of people away, because it was now a DA thing and branded like that and with all the relative toxicity associated with one particular party, when actually it should have been a collective announcement of a bunch of parties. So I think that was part of the problem. But the reason why we ultimately believed that we could proceed is after months of engagement, and there were months of these engagements, it came down to one point of disagreement, is that the DA was refusing to rule out coalition with the ANC. Refusing. And even when we were there at Kempton Park in the convention, it was the only major point of disagreement. And eventually they capitulated and they agreed to Clause 7, the Declaration of Intent, that said that no political party here will co-govern with the ANC after the elections. And they presented it to you, members of the media, and South Africans. And we thought, well, you know, if you stand up and present this, you know, how could they possibly renege? And yet, you look at the MPC and it fills the ranks of the ANC's government, which is a whole other discussion, because actually the way the ANC has handled the demise of their majority has been masterful. I mean, even just at a political level, you've got to look at the situation where they were the biggest losers in the election and the biggest winners in the negotiations.
I have to go because we're running out of time, but you present an interesting argument, and then it begs the question around Tshwane then.
Sure.
I have to introduce Tshwane, and a lot of talk has been about the hypocrisy of Action SA. Action SA has said one thing and it's now doing another. There's even this position that Hemen is now took that, you know, you will consider it going into a GNU. And I want to understand the logic behind
sure.
Getting out of that coalition with the DA in Tshwane, where some people, there's been people who say that it was starting to see some results. And moving into a coalition with the ANC and the EFF, whom you have said in the past have not really done anything for the people of both Johannesburg and Ekurhuleni.
So let's look at it this way. Right after the 29 May elections, Action SA Senate got together and started a review of our processes. And one of the things that we came to a conclusion of is that the nature of politics has changed. And, you know, we can stick to positions, but if you stick to a position in a changing world, you're a dinosaur. Mm. And we wish other political parties had shared our view about being an alternative to the ANC. But as you saw, it didn't happen. And, you know, when you are a relatively smaller political party in the electoral landscape, and things have changed where people are breaking down the barriers of who you do and don't govern with, are we going to stick to a position that voters rewarded with 1.29% of the vote? I mean, surely not. I mean, if people really wanted Action SA to stick to that position, why didn't they vote for us in greater numbers? And that's why we must respond to an election. And this election clearly told us that we need to reconsider that position. We need to perhaps be a bit more mature to realize that the decision around who you work with should be based on the particular area and the residents of that area in question. And there's no contradiction for us to say on one breath, we do not think that the GNU needs any more parties in government when it now constitutes 71% of parliament. Mm. And actually, with an opposition that's thoroughly useless, we need to have a rational opposition that is constructive on one hand, so not just out there for political point scoring, but actually holds its government to account. But then yet in Tshwane, you have a situation where things are falling apart. And this is where I love it when people say things are getting better. Where? In other words, please, the other day I was in an interview and someone said things are getting better. I said, which things? And there was this awkward silence for like 45 seconds because people who say that can't follow it up with another bullet point. And it worries me because what we've seen in Tshwane is the ugliest side of South African politics, where bad government is okay if it's being delivered by someone who looks like me and talks like me. Yeah. And that's some nasty stuff that we've got to run away from. Bad government must be bad government, and good government must be good government. And if someone coming from a political party you fundamentally disagree with delivers service as well, so be it. I mean, I was watching this EFF MMC of Environment and Agriculture on the ground yesterday. Now, I don't like him. I fundamentally disagree with his politics. I find some of the statements he's made abhorrent, but he's there cleaning up communities on his first day on the job or second day on the job. And that's what I like about local government. You can be practical and you can be pragmatic, and it's about service delivery at the end of the day. We learned that in Joburg, where you could have budgets being passed by the Freedom Front and the EFF simultaneously, because local government about roads, electricity, water, sewer, and those issues aren't ideological. They're very practical. And we had to look at a situation, say we're forming part of a broken government. It's not delivering at all. The racial skew in the experience of this government is shocking, to the point that 2/3 of people and 75% of people living in townships saying it's gotten worse or stayed the same. And ultimately, we had to do something. Now, if the expectation from all of our critics is that Action SA should sit on its hands and should be the DA's cheerleader when it's failing, then I'm sorry, they obviously have an expectation that Action SA is not an independent political party, and our strings should be pulled by Helen Zille or whoever. But ultimately, what we've done is we've created an arrangement where Action SA leads a government. We have a mayor. We have the ability to show the people of this very troubled province and South Africa more broadly that there's a third way to yellow and blue, both of whom have let them down very badly in Gauteng. And there's a green way. And that's exactly what we're going to do. And to all those critics, I say, judge it by its delivery. Don't judge it on the basis of its composition. Judge it on the basis of whether it is able to deliver services, whether it can improve the broken city that we've inherited, whether it can stabilize the financial position, which is basically bankrupt, and whether it can do so in a manner that is ethical and transparent. And despite the challenges we will face in that process, I have ultimate confidence in Dr. Nasipi Moyo as someone who's going to do an excellent job. And I think the residents of Tshwane will end up seeing that.
Now, as we wind down this interview, I have a couple of people that I want you to describe in three words. I want you to describe him and Mashaba in three words.
Self-made, if I can call that one word. Decisive. Engaging.
Musimaimani.
Charismatic. Magnetic. Charming.
James Self.
Strong, visionary, far-sighted.
Lindiwe Mazibuko.
Sure. Also say she's charismatic. She's dynamic. And she's pioneering.
John Steenhuisen.
It's hard to say. He's analytical. He was an excellent chief whip in Parliament. He understands the rules and stuff very well. He's charming. When you're around John, he's a charming person. He's engaging, makes you feel like the only person in the room. So he's got those dynamics. But perhaps you'd have to say weak. Someone who... no one actually believes he's in charge of his own organization.
Helen Ziller.
Let's get my lawyer here for this. Definitely outdated. Should have retired. Tenuous grasp on reality, if I can make that one word. Divisive.
And finally, Michael Bormann.
Oh, that's the worst one. I mean, how do you possibly answer that? Say developing. I kind of see myself always on a developmental journey. Still make lots of mistakes, still learning from them. Well-intentioned. I do things for the right reasons, even when they're unpopular. Doing them for the right reasons. I see I get the benefit of explaining my words at least, which is good. Patriotic.
Thank you.
Love my country.
Thank you. Thank you, Michael, for your time. Thank you for listening to this week's episode of Beyond Politics. Review and subscribe to Iyono FM, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you choose to get your podcasts. This podcast is a Times Live original podcast and our producer is Thabo Tshabalala. Don't forget, you can also listen to our other podcasts, Sunday Times Politics Weekly, Taking the Rams by the Horns, Business Day Spotlight, Gogo, I Have Been Scammed.